nanohub.org.
Online simulation and more for nanotechnology.
All right. Any questions about the homework? Hopefully you all had a chance to look at it. Okay. Should pretty much follow all the concepts we talked about in class related to multi-level optimization. The last question requires what I'm going to be talking about today in class on technology mapping, but you know, once we finish class today, you should be more or less set to be able to solve all the questions. Okay, so let's start this lecture talking about, continuing to talk about technology mapping. Quick recap of what we discussed in the previous lecture. Technology mapping realizes a Boolean circuit, a circuit of logic gates using cells from a given technology library in an optimal fashion. Technology mapping, we saw, can be formulated as a graph covering problem where you take the circuit that you're trying to map and represent it as a graph called the subject graph. You also take the cells from your technology library and represent them using smaller graphs known as pattern graphs. And then the problem becomes one of covering the subject graph using instances of the pattern graphs, right? And, with this general approach, the main challenge really is the complexity of DAG covering. So, you know, covering a graph using smaller graphs is fundamentally an NP-hard problem. Unfortunately, it remains NP-hard even when all nodes have n degree of less than or equal to 2. And this, you know, reason I mentioned this special case is because you can always take any circuit and break it in terms of two input gates, and therefore your nodes will have n degree of less than or equal to 2, but that doesn't really impact the worst case computational complexity of the problem. So there's two major solution approaches that have been pursued. First of them is to formulate graph covering as a binate row covering problem. We've seen repeatedly instances of the covering problem in design automation. We saw it in two-level minimization. We also saw it in multi-level minimization when we talked about identifying kernels and co-kernels and extracting common factors. So covering is a problem that was very well studied already in design automation, and therefore it was natural for people to try to reuse those well-optimized or well-studied algorithms and see if they could be reused for this problem. And the second approach is one of decomposing the DAG into trees and taking advantage of a efficient algorithm that exists for the special case where the DAG has a tree structure. So, as we mentioned in the previous lecture, the main difference between a DAG and a tree is that in a DAG you can have reconvergent fan-out, whereas in a tree you cannot, right? It turns out that if both the subject graph and the pattern graph are trees, that is, the out degree of each node is 1, then an efficient algorithm exists. In fact, a polynomial complexity, relatively low polynomial complexity algorithm exists to solve the problem optimally. Okay? So one approach is to take the DAG, break it up into trees, and then map those trees optimally, put the results back together. So we will look at both of these approaches, starting with the binate covering approach first. Of course, we all recall covering from two-level minimization and, more recently, technology-independent multi-level minimization. In the two-level context, we had a covering table where rows were minterms, columns were primes, and we had to select a minimum subset of columns such that all the rows were covered, right? And a column was said to cover a row if the corresponding entry corresponding to that column in the row in the covering table is a 1, right? So this was the, this is an example of a covering table, primes, minterms, select a subset of primes such that all minterms are covered. This type of covering problem, it turns out, is what is referred to as a unate covering problem. Okay? And the reason I'm mentioning that is because there is actually two types of covering problems, unate and binate. Okay, we talked about unate and binate functions. There is a relationship which will become apparent shortly. But this type of problem is called a unate covering problem. Why is it unate? Because of the fact that a row can be covered only by the inclusion of a column. Okay, so in order to cover a row, you need to include a column. In contrast, as we will see in binate covering problems, exclusion of a column can also cover a row. Okay, the way the problem is defined here, because of the semantics of minterms and primes and what you're going to get accomplished, is that The only way to cover a row is by including a column. Excluding a column cannot help you in any way. Okay? So therefore, it is called a unit covering problem. Another way to look at this is if you write down the constraints imposed by the covering table as a CNF formula. Remember Petrick's method, where we took each of these minterms and said, hey, one of the primes that covers this minterm has got to be included. Only then this minterm is going to be covered. So that gives you a clause. M1 is an essential, or P1 is an essential prime in this case, it turns out, because M1 is only covered by P1. So you have this capital P1, which is a Boolean variable, indicating whether or not prime P1 is going to be included in your solution. And you have this single literal clause with capital P1, right? Essentially forcing it to be included. Similarly, M2 will be covered only by if either prime P1 or prime P2 or prime P8 are included in the cover, therefore capital P1 plus P2 plus P8 is your second clause, and so on. So each of the rows in this covering table is transformed into one of the clauses in the CNF formula. If you look at the CNF formula, does anything strike you for the CNF formula? All the literals in this formula are uncomplemented, right? All the variables here, the capital P1 through capital P8, are all appearing here in uncomplemented form. Therefore, if you think of this as a Boolean function, it is a unit function. Okay, so that's another way of rationalizing this covering table, or all covering tables that arise in two-level minimization are instances of unit covering problems. Okay, so this is, with this quick background, let's look at a different class of covering problems, namely binate covering problems, which is what will be useful in technology mapping. So in binate covering problems, we also model constraints that require exclusion of some columns or conditional exclusion of columns. Okay. So rows may be covered either by including or by excluding a column. For example, here's a covering table. Okay. The entries of the covering table, in this case, the labels, I've just kept the labels to be M and P, but do not interpret them as minterms and primes. Okay. So these are just row labels and column labels now. Okay. So there is no connection to two-level minimization here. The table entries in this case can either be 0, 1, or a dash. The 1 entry is the same as the unit covering case. In other words, including P1 will cover M1. Okay, including the first column will cover the first row when you have 1 entry. A 0 entry has a different meaning in this case. The 0 entry in a binate covering table means that leaving out this column, not including it in your final cover, will actually cover that row. Okay, so there are two ways of covering a row. In unit covering problems, the only way to cover a row is by including one of the columns that had a 1 entry in that row. In the case of a binate covering problem, you can cover a row either by including one of the columns that has a 1 entry or by excluding a column that has a 0 entry. Okay, so if you look at M1, for example, M1 can be covered by including P1 in your final cover, or by excluding P2, or by excluding P5. Okay, and a dash really, in this case, plays the role of a 0 in the unit case, which is that the inclusion or exclusion of this column has no bearing on the row. So P3 and P4, in this case, have no bearing on M1, whether M1 is covered. Okay, so instead of just 0 and 1, here in the binate covering problems, you have 0, 1, and dash. The 1 is like the 1 in the unit case, the dash is like the 0 in the unit case, and the 0 here is actually totally different, right? Because it models a new sort of constraint, the exclusion constraint. Okay? Everything clear so far? Okay. So with these binate covering problems, another reason these are binate, or these are called binate, is if you look at the equivalent CNF formula, just the way we wrote down a CNF formula from unit covering problems, we can do the same with binate covering problems. Right? The equivalent formula here is that M1 can be covered either by the inclusion of P1, therefore capital P1, or by exclusion of P2, so you have P2 prime, or by exclusion of P5, therefore you have P5 prime. So as you can see here, this function is a binate function because it has both variables and their complements, right? You have P1 and P1 prime, you have P2, P2 prime, and so on, okay? So it is not unit in all of its input variables. Therefore, this is a binate covering problem. Okay, so binate covering problems you can think of as a more general version of unit covering problems. We haven't seen them quite yet, but it is a simple generalization. Now, the reason we talked about binate covering problems is because, yes, Asad.
For the unit covering problems, just a trivial question: is there any specific reason why they use zero and not just a dash?
It's just notation. You could use a dash too.
Okay.
It's just notation. Yeah. I guess the people who came up with the notation didn't really think of the binate case. If not, if you would like to come up with a consistent notation, I agree. You know, maybe one could just use one and dash here and one zero dash in the other place. But it's just a notation. Okay. So the reason we talked about binate covering problems is because technology mapping can actually be formulated. One of the solution approaches that was explored for technology mapping is to formulate it as a binate covering problem. Okay. And we'll illustrate that using a simple circuit that is shown here. Okay. So this is an unmapped circuit. It has not been mapped to any technology library yet. As we discussed in the previous lecture, the circuit has been expressed. You can think of this as a subject graph because all the Boolean expressions in the nodes of your Boolean network have been decomposed into two input NAND gates and inverters. So you have this, and this is a subject graph. So the first step in approach of technology mapping using binate covering is to compute all possible matches in the subject graph using the pattern graphs. So what you do is you take each of the gates in your library, each of the pattern graphs, and then kind of slide them over the subject graph and try to see where you have matches. That's a straightforward pattern matching problem, right? So if you're taking a NAND 2 as a cell from the library, you will see that the NAND 2 is going to match here at gate 9. It's going to match at gate 7, gate 5, gate 3, and gate 4, right? So you have all of those matches. If you have a NAND 3, where would a NAND 3 match? Can you see a match for NAND 3? Do you know what a NAND 3 looks like? This is a NAND 3, right? This is a 3-input NAND, right here. This is another 3-input NAND. So that's another possibility of a match, okay? So, given a pattern graph, you can just slide it over the subject graph conceptually to compute all the matches. Okay? That sounds like an expensive process. It is an expensive process, but it's not exponential. Okay? It's still polynomial complexity because basically think of it as for each pattern graph, you're doing a linear traversal of the circuit and asking, is there a match here? Is there a match here? Is there a match at any of the gates? Right? So, of course, you need to multiply that by the number of pattern graphs, right? So it is a complex, of substantial computation, but not exponential. So suppose you do this. This is the first step. You compute all the matches. For each match, you need to record the following. You need to record the cost of the match. Cost is directly available from the library, right? For each cell in the library, you have a cost. The cost represents the area or the delay or the power. We just abstract it as a number called the cost. You also know which nodes in the subject graph that match covers. Right. So, for example, if you're matching NAND 3, one possible match is going to be here, and it's going to cover nodes 7, 8, and 9. You also record which are the inputs of the match, meaning that if I were to use this match in my final cover, what inputs would be required to feed that instance of the cell when I instantiate that cell. And here you say that I need the output of gate 6 in the subject graph. I need C, the primary input C, and I need the primary input D. So these would be the inputs of the match. What is the output of the match? The primary output O2 would be the output of the match, right? So you record all of this information for each possible match. And we'll see an example, right? So I've just repeated the same thing here. So let's look at the circuit here. Assuming that you have a library consisting of these gates, inverter, NAND 2, NAND 3, XNOR 2, NAND 4, and OI 2, 1, these would be the matches that you can actually. And this library actually is a subset of what you have, the example library I gave in the previous lecture. So as a homework exercise, I'm not going to go through this first step of computing all possible matches. We're going to focus on what comes after that. That's the interesting part. This is relatively straightforward. But as a homework exercise, I'd like you to go through that library that we looked at in the previous lecture, go through all the possible matches and ensure that, you know, all the possibilities are indeed listed here and these are all correct matches. So if you look at the cell inverter from your library, you know, that's straightforward. There are four matches for inverter because there's four inverters in the circuit and you see the four matches here listed as each match is just given a unique name, match M1, match M2, match M6 and match M8. Okay. What is the type of the cell that match represents? The cost. This is just from the library. What are the inputs of the match? So if you look at implementing this as just a single inverter cell, it requires the input B and it will generate the, so we've used a notation here where each of the gates here is numbered in the subject graph, and that gate is called GI. Its output, the output signal of that gate is called TI. T is just a temporary signal or an intermediate signal, TI. So that's the notation I'm using here. Okay? So TI is nothing but the output of gate GI. So match M1 covers gate 1, G1, and it takes in as input B, it produces T1, it has a cost of 1. Let's look at something a little more complex. So we said there are two NAND 3s. So M10 is one instance of NAND 3, which covers gates G7, G8, and G9. And that's exactly what I talked about before, G7, G8, and G9. It produces T9. T9 is essentially, in this case, the same as output O2. And it requires T6, C, and D as its inputs. Okay? So that's the NAND 3 M10, the match M10 here. The other match for NAND 3 consists of gates 4, 6, and 7, these three together. And it requires as inputs A, C, and D, as you can see that. Or is it A, B, and C? Yeah, I'm sorry. It is A, B, and C. This right here. Yeah, D just goes through later. So I should ignore that. B, C, and A. Okay? So it requires those as inputs, and it produces T7 as the output, and it has a cost of 3 again. So for every match, you tabulate the instances where that occurs. For every cell in the pattern, set of pattern graphs or your library, you tabulate the instances where that cell can be used potentially in the circuit, the cost, the inputs and outputs. So given this information, now the problem is, this is when you need to solve the optimization problem of which subset of these matches to use. This is probably more matches than you actually need, because you're computing all possible matches from between the pattern graphs of the library and the subject graph, right? You don't need all possible instances. The same gate may be appearing in several different matches. You only need to cover each gate once. So you potentially have more than you need here, and you need to take an optimal subset of this that covers all the gates. Okay, so now let's look at that problem. So now we consider each of these matches that we looked at previously as represented as a Boolean variable, right? The Boolean variable just indicates the inclusion or exclusion of this match in the cover. The final cover is a subset of these matches, right? So these are the potential matches that you have, M1 through M14. You need to pick a subset of these matches such that some constraints are satisfied. So we'll have 14 corresponding Boolean variables, and each Boolean variable will say whether each of these matches is included in the final cover or not, right? So those are your Boolean variables. MI is 0 means the match is excluded. MI is 1 means the match is included. Now the problem reduces to determining the cost optimal assignment to these Boolean variables subject to some constraints. The big question is, what are those constraints? Right? What are the constraints that ensure that a subset of these matches, if selected, is a valid cover for the circuit, right? And once you have these MIs and the constraints formulated, we will see that they can actually be tabulated into a binate covering table where your variables, the MIs, these are the variables that you can select, your independent variables of optimization, and the rows will end up becoming the constraints that govern what subset of those variables can be selected. So what are those constraints? It turns out there are three constraints that you need to consider. The first constraint is rather straightforward, right? The fact that each node in the subject graph needs to be covered at least once by at least one match. Why? Because you'd like a technology mapping of this entire circuit. If you gave me the circuit and I told you, okay, let me map just three of the nodes, you're going to say, that's not a complete cover of the circuit. Cover the entire circuit for me. So the first constraint just says that I need to cover the entire circuit. However, there is an interesting clause here. Each node in the subject graph can actually be covered in some cases by more than one match. Okay? And it turns out that while that seems counterintuitive, it appears that you're actually duplicating transistors by doing that, or duplicating gates. It turns out that it may actually enable higher quality matches and therefore actually lower the overall cost of the circuit. So for now, we'll look at an example of when that's okay to do. But for now, let's just assume that it is okay to cover each gate here needs to be covered in at least one of the matches, one or more. Okay, that's constraint number one. Constraint number two is you need to make sure that the inputs of any match in the cover are available. Okay? What does that mean? Eventually, you need to take this circuit and all the matches that you compute and generate a technology mapped netlist. What will that technology mapped circuit look like? It'll say, here is this cell, maybe let's say XOR, from the library. The inputs of this XOR are either coming from the primary inputs or they have to come from another cell instance that you've created, right? So a well-structured, well-formed cover is one that will enable you to write out a technology mapped circuit where you can actually have a bunch of instances of those library cells and connect them up together in a valid manner. We'll see an example of when a cover may actually not lend to such a clean structure, but you need to make sure that the inputs of each map, so if you, for example, if you looked at the NAND 3 match that we talked about, the match with of gate 7, 8, 9, you need to make sure that T6, this signal here, is available as the output of some other match, okay? So that you can connect it up in your final circuit appropriately. Or, of course, if it's a primary input, you don't need to care because primary inputs are always available, okay? So you need to make sure, once again, that the inputs of each match that you finally select in your cover are either primary inputs or outputs of other matches in that same selected cover. And finally, you need to make sure that the primary output is produced also as the output of a match in the cover. You cannot say that I have, a NAND 3 starting here with some other inverter and NAND 2 there, because this signal is going to be some internal signal of that cell. It's not available as a primary output, right? So a cell should finish here. This should be generated. So these are the three constraints that you, or sets of constraints that you need to consider in order to ensure that the solution to the covering problem can be transformed into a valid circuit. So here's an example of logic duplication that I talked about. If this were one match, okay, this could be another match. And in this case, what we've done is we've included gate 4 in both these matches. And that's okay. In practice, what will happen is you'll have one instance of gate 4 as part of this cell, another instance of gate 4 as part of this cell. You replicated gate 4 to go into each of those matches. If your overall cost of this solution is the lowest, so be it. That's okay. This is fine. But what is not okay is this, right? Because, so here what we've done is we've taken the blue match here corresponds to one instance of NAND 3. The brown or yellow match here corresponds to another instance of NAND 3. However, the input of the second instance, which is T6, is actually buried somewhere within the first instance. It's not available as an output. So this is not acceptable. So this kind of overlap is okay, but this kind of overlap is not acceptable. And these constraints just ensure that, you know, you'll allow these cases, but not these cases. Okay. Any questions? Okay. So what we need to do is come up with this binate covering problem by encoding those three sets of constraints that I just talked about. Right? We can encode them either in the form of a table or in the form of clauses. Both are equivalent. So here we'll look at an example. The same running example as before. Given this table which just enumerates all the matches, how do we encode the constraints, the three sets of constraints? The first constraint, as we saw, was that each node in your subject graph must be covered by at least one match. So that's relatively straightforward. For each gate here, for let's say gate G1, look at which are the matches that include, that cover gate G1. So if you look at wherever G1 appears here in the last column, G1 appears in match M1, M12, and M14, right? So what you say is that either M1 has to be included in the final cover or M12 or M14. That's the only way gate 1, if your subject graph is going to be covered. Similarly, you go do that for each and every one of the gates, and you get a bunch of clauses here, okay? So this is the first constraint encoded into clauses. The second constraint, if you recall, was that each input of a selected match must either be a primary input or the output of some other selected match. This is a slightly more tricky constraint to encode, okay? But again, it is possible to encode it. So what you do is you look at every match that requires a temporary, look at the inputs of each of these matches. If a match only requires primary inputs, you don't need to produce any constraints here. On the other hand, if a match requires a temporary signal, one of the internal signals in the subject graph, you need to ensure that one of the other matches that produces this as an output is also included in the cover. Okay? So in other words, M3 requires T1 and T2 as its inputs. Which is the other match that can produce T1? Well, there's only one match that can produce T1. It is match M1. So what you need to do is, if M3 is included in the cover, you need to also force M1 to be included in the cover so that T1 is available to connect its output to the input of M3. So that is actually encoded by this constraint, M3 prime or M1. Remember our implication, when we talked about implication and how it could be encoded as a Boolean function, right? Essentially, what we are saying is M3 implies M1. If M3 is 1, you have to force M1 also to be 1. And this is nothing but M3 prime or M1 is just an encoding of this constraint. Similarly, the other input of M3 is T2. So if you need to look at which matches, other matches produce T2, and it turns out M2 is the only one that produces T2. So M3, including M3 in the cover, should also force M2 to be included in the cover. So you have this other clause, M3 prime or M2. So for every match that requires inputs that are not primary inputs, you enumerate such constraints. Look at the signals that they require as their inputs, look at which other matches produce those signals, and force one of those other matches to be included. And if you go ahead and do this for match M5, you will see that you have a couple of clauses, similarly match M6, and so on and so forth. Okay? So you can go through all of the matches here that require intermediate variables in the subject graph as their inputs, and put down these constraints. So that gives you a second set of constraints. Final set of constraints says that the primary outputs must be the outputs of some matches that you selected in your cover, so that you can take them and say this is the output of your circuit. Yes, Asad.
I missed the fact. Why are they complementary?
Oh, because the M3 prime or M1 is just an encoding of the constraint of the implication M3 equals M1. M3 equals 1 should force M1 also to be 1. And this is just a way of encoding that as a clause. So. Okay. The final set of constraints is the fact that the two primary outputs of the circuit must also be outputs of matches. So you look at, you know, which matches produce T5 in this case, which is same as O1. So you see that M5 produces T5, M12 produces an M14. So either M5, M12, or M14 has to be in the final cover. Similarly, for T9, you say that M9, M10, or M13 needs to be in the final cover. Now, you have these three sets of constraints. You put all these clauses together. Take the conjunction of everything. That gives you your binate covering problem. Right? You can think of it as a table as well. Right? You can write each of these clauses is nothing but one row in the table. If you have uncomplemented literals, you put ones in those entries. If you have complemented literals, you put zeros in the entries. And everything else is a dash. Okay? So, given this covering problem, you can then solve it. Remember, you need to find the minimum cost solution. Okay? So here, the cost of the solution, unlike the case of the two-level minimization where you're just counting the number of columns in the cover, in this case, it actually, each column has a certain number associated with it, which is the cost of that match. Right? So you need to sum up those costs. So it is a generalized version of the covering problem in that sense as well, where you have weights for each of the columns. And you need to select a minimum, a subset of the columns with minimum cumulative weight such that all the rows are covered or all these clauses are satisfied. And it turns out in this case, if you go ahead and solve the problem, you'll see that the least cost solution is actually this. And this solution uses two gates. Because if you see, all the variables except two are complemented. So that means all these matches are excluded from the cover. Only two, M12 and M13 are included in the cover. And it turns out that M12 is just a XNOR gate, M13 is a 4-input NAND gate, for a total cost of 9. So your circuit is just covered by these two gates alone. Even though you had all those options, all that you need is just two gates. Okay? And note here again that you have that legitimate form of replication where gate 4 is duplicated between both of, or covered by both of the instances, both of the patterns that you covered, included, both of the matches that you included in the final cover. So, any questions on how this process works? All right. So, you know, the challenges with this. So, it works pretty well in practice. So, you can, you know, automate this process. And this was the first approach that people actually tried, the first systematic approach that people tried to technology mapping. Unfortunately, it found to be not very scalable. As circuits grew larger and larger, the runtimes of the technology mappers did not scale very gracefully. And the reason is basically that binate covering is intrinsically a very hard problem. Well, we know that, you can say that you knew that covering is a hard problem. You know, you've solved two-level covering before. Two-level covering is NP complete or NP hard. You knew that, right? So why start once you knew something like that and then, you know, hit a wall? Well, it turns out that binet covering is in practice, in worst case, both are NP-hard, but in practice, as we talked about in exact two-level minimization, in Espresso Exact, there are a whole bunch of techniques, pruning techniques, branch and bound, that work very well. It turns out that those properties, of there are some inherent structural properties of unit covering problems that lend themselves to efficient use of such techniques in practice. So even the exact two-level minimization algorithms that we talked about scale reasonably well, but once you come to binet covering problems, you lose that structure of unitness in the covering problem that makes it much, much more difficult. For example, in the case of unit covering problem, finding a feasible solution, forget about minimum solution, finding a feasible solution is trivial. Just include all the primes in the cover. You know all the minterms will be covered. In the case of binet covering problem, right, finding a feasible solution, if you remove the cost function, just satisfying all the constraints itself is SAT. It boils down to SAT. And that itself is NP-complete. Okay, so hopefully that illustrates that the binet covering problem is, you know, in the case of unit covering, it's trivial, but just finding a feasible solution in binet covering itself is NP-complete. So it's much more complex, and people realize that this approach was not really going very far in practice. Of course, the other issue also is that the problem size itself is very large, because that table that we computed with all the matches, that can be potentially large, right? When you have many instances of each of the pattern graphs appearing in the circuit, you have a large number of rows. The cost function, finally, and this probably is, you know, as much of a problem as any others, cost function is not very flexible. The covering problem inherently requires an additive cost function, meaning that, you know, the cost of your total solution is the sum of the costs of the individual matches. That works very well for area and not very well for some of the other cost functions that we will see. Okay? Delay is certainly apparent, because delay is a function of the longest path in the circuit. You don't add up the delays of all the gates in your circuit. You only add up the delays on the longest path, right? So the cost function is not very flexible. So for a variety of reasons, binet covering was abandoned, and the attention switched to a different approach to solving the covering problem that we will next talk about, right? So in this approach, as we briefly mentioned before, you take your DAG, your subject graph, which is a directed acyclic graph, decompose it into trees, and then cover each of the trees in an optimal way using an extremely efficient algorithm. So we are exploiting the property that if the subject graph and pattern graphs happen to be trees, then very efficient covering algorithms do exist. And these are very interesting and elegant algorithms. Basically use the paradigm of dynamic programming. Initially used, so the use of dynamic programming here in technology mapping was actually inspired by the first techniques used for code generation in compilers. And even today, modern compilers commonly use these techniques for code generation. Originally proposed by Aho and Johnson in 1975. The key idea is to partition. So in the case of the compiler, the graph that you're talking about is the control data flow graph of your program, right? You have your program written in a high-level programming language. Compiler front-end translates it into some sort of a control data flow graph. You need to map that into machine instructions. Machine instructions are the patterns. You need to cover your subject graph with patterns. So the problem fundamentally is the same. And this was, Aho and Johnson suggested the use of dynamic programming to solve the code generation problem there in compilers. And the key idea is, as we said, to partition the DAG into a forest of trees and use the efficient algorithm on each tree. So conceptually, you can think of this as your larger circuit. We will see that sometimes when you're partitioning it into trees, sometimes you have some overlap between the trees. Again, that corresponds to replication of small amounts of logic. That's okay if it helps you to both lower the computational complexity as well as the cost in some cases of the overall cover. For technology mapping, the person who first proposed the use of dynamic programming for technology mapping in logic synthesis was Kurt Koitzer, who was at the time at AT&T Bell Labs and, you know, currently is a professor at UC Berkeley. His paper was published about 12 years after the paper on code generation in compilers. Right? And so, you know, it clearly acknowledges inspiration from that other domain. Okay? So let's look at how this works. In order to do that, since not all of you may have had an introduction to dynamic programming, I'm going to very quickly go over it. and then shift our attention to how technology mapping is actually accomplished of a tree is actually accomplished using dynamic programming. Dynamic programming is a method of solving optimization problems that exhibit certain properties, certain special properties. And those properties, there's two key properties of an optimization problem that you need to look for to see whether dynamic programming applies. Okay. One of them is called overlapping subproblems, and the other is known as optimal substructure. We'll see what these mean. Optimal substructure just means that the optimal solutions to subproblems can be composed to find an optimal solution to the overall problem. Okay, so put in simple terms, you can use a divide and conquer approach to your original problem without losing optimality. You can take your larger problem, and there is a way to divide it into smaller problems such that you can compute the optimal solution for each of the smaller problems, step back and put those optimal solutions together, you still have optimal solution to the overall problem, right? So that is the notion of optimal substructure. Not every optimization problem can affords you that luxury. So if you look at two-level minimization, for example, you can't take your covering table and divide it into two parts and say that I'll use some primes to cover this part of minterms, I'll use some other primes to cover these minterms, and then put it back together. You can do that if they are block disjoint matrices, as we saw in Espresso. Only in that special case. You can't do that in general. Well, in problems that are amenable to dynamic programming, you can always do that. Okay, you can divide your problem into subproblems and solve the subproblems optimally, put them together. The other interesting property is one of overlapping subproblems. This basically says that the solution, optimal solution of a subproblem is context independent. In other words, as I'm decomposing my large problem into smaller problems, which I could do recursively, by the way, I could take my big problem, break it into two, take each of the parts, break them again into two, and so on. As I am doing this recursive decomposition, if I come across a subproblem that I've seen before, that is identical to something I've seen before, I don't need to recompute the solution. I can just reuse the solution that I had computed before, if I remember it. Okay? So the optimal solution to the subproblem has to be context independent in order to enable you to do that. Right? And that is referred to as the property of overlapping subproblems. So if an optimization problem satisfies these two criteria, it is very likely going to be solvable using dynamic programming. Okay? This was originally described by Bellman. Some of you may know the Bellman-Ford algorithm for finding shortest paths in a graph. I'll let you go through this, but the objective function in a problem that exhibits these two properties is typically represented as a recursive equation. Okay? So in all the problems that you solve using dynamic programming, typically the minimum cost of your entire problem is represented in terms of the minimum costs of subproblems, but the way you break your problem into subproblems is usually by making some sort of a local choice. Okay? And we'll see what that local choice means. But that local choice that you make to partition your problem into subproblems will have a certain cost, direct cost associated with it. And that is the local cost of the choice. And all that you need to do here is you need to enumerate the local choices. Okay? So you may need to do some enumeration, but only locally. You don't need to enumerate all combinations of choices. So this recursive call to min cost on the subproblems essentially is possible due to the optimal substructure. Let's look at an example that will hopefully make it clear. Let's look at the problem of finding a shortest path in a directed graph, right? So this is an example of a directed graph. You have vertices or nodes, edges. Edges have arrows on them, so therefore directed. Each of the edges has a certain weight, okay? So this could be, for example, a problem representing, you know, this could be your network of roads, right? And intersections between the roads, and you may be trying to find, you know, your GPS may be trying to find the shortest way to get you from point A to point B, right? So, in this case, it turns out that the cost of a vertex is the length of the shortest, what we would like to find is the shortest path from the source to the destination, from S to T. We denote the cost of any vertex, any of the vertices here, as the length of the shortest path from that vertex to the destination. So cost of C is the shortest path from C to T, cost of A is the shortest path from A to T, and so on. So it turns out that you can express cost of I as the minimum over all outgoing edges from that vertex, I, as, you know, the dik, which is the weight of that edge, plus the cost of k. In other words, the cost of s can be represented as the minimum of two cases. From s, you have two choices. Your local choices are your shortest path goes through c, or your shortest path goes through D. Those are your two local choices you need to enumerate. But once you enumerate the local choices, you can just say, express the cost of S as one minimum of two possibilities, one plus the cost of C, one is the weight of the edge here, or if you take this approach, it's going to be four plus the cost of D. And you can do the same thing for each of the vertices. Cost of C is min of 3 plus cost of A and 6 plus cost of B. Cost of D is min of 2 plus cost of A, 5 plus cost of B, and so on. Okay. And cost of A, of course, you know there's only one way to get from A to T. So cost of A is 5 plus cost of T. Cost of B is 3 plus cost of T. Of course, cost of T itself is 0, right? Because that is the destination. You are at the destination. So now what you can do is you can walk backwards. Once you have these equations, you can solve these equations. This is just a bunch of linear equations. You can solve these equations by walking backwards from T and go back to S and find the minimum cost. So if you look at cost of A, we know that cost of A is 5 because cost of T is 0. Similarly, you know that cost of B is 3. Now you have a choice, right? Cost of C is minimum of 3 plus 5 and 6 plus 3. So you go with 8, you go with 3 plus 5. Okay, so the interesting thing is once you computed the minimum cost of a vertex, you don't need to recompute it again. We just label the vertices. But now we look at cost of D. Again, cost of D just requires cost of A and cost of B, but you already computed them. You don't need to recompute them anymore. You just need to look at your local choices, perform this min operation, and decide. So in this case, it turns out that it is 2 plus 5, which is 7. And finally, you come to cost of S, and you see that the cost of S is, the min cost of S is 9. So this path turns out to be the shorter one, right? And by looking at the decisions that you made when you computed the min cost of each vertex, you can actually trace out backwards the shortest path from S to T. Okay. Now, let's come back to tree covering. Suppose your subject graph is a tree. How do you use dynamic programming to solve that? The same recursive structure that we talked about for the cost function in the shortest path problem also applies to covering. For each node I in a subject tree, you can express the min cost of I as the minimum over all matches at I, all the local matches. You can take all the pattern graph instances that can match at this node, and those are your local choices. In the shortest path problem, which edge, outgoing edge do I take was your local choice. Here, I have different possibilities of matching at this node locally. Those are your local choices. So you need to take the minimum over all those local choices, all the matches at that vertex I, or of the cost of Gij. So Gij is just a way of, j is just an index that runs over all the local matches. Cost of Gij plus sigma over the inputs of j, the minimum cost of kj. What does that mean? Let's look at that visually and it should become pretty apparent. So this is node I. It's some node in a tree. The min cost covering of this point, of the subtree rooted at this point, the entire subtree, is nothing but minimum over all such matches. Suppose you have one match here of Gij, which has two inputs. So what is the cost of this local choice? Well, it is the cost of Gij plus the cost of covering these subtrees. But that min cost of covering the subtrees is your recursive call to this min cost function, right? So in this case, you have k1 and k2 as the two inputs of the match. So you need to compute the min cost of these subtrees and add to that the cost of this. That's one option. Now you may have a different match here, which may have different inputs. So you need to compute the cost, consider that possibility where you consider that match and the cost of those inputs as well. So just to illustrate it differently, for example, you have the root of the tree, and let's suppose that there is three possible matches. One match which requires two inputs A and B, another match which requires three inputs X, Y, and Z, and a third match which requires four inputs J, K, L, and M. So this is your tree of gates representing your subject graph. So we call it a subject tree now. There is three possible instances of cells from the library, pattern graphs, that can match at the root of this tree. So now, how do you express the min cost cover at the root of the tree? Min cost of the root is the cost of P1. P1 is this match, this pink match here, plus the min cost of A plus min cost of B, because you need to compute some way of covering all the subtrees rooted at A and B. So this is one possibility. comma, or the cost of P2 plus min cost of X plus min cost of Y plus min cost of Z, or cost of P3 plus min cost of JK, L, and M. Right? So these are the three possibilities or the three local choices you need to enumerate. This sounds like you're enumerating all possibilities. It is not. There is a subtle but very important difference. The min cost of A, B, all of these are computed only once. You are not looking at the combinations of choices here and other choices you have to cover the gates within these subtrees. You only, once you've computed the min cost of one node, you don't need to recompute it again. Okay? That is the critical difference. So in this case, the principle of optimality states that the optimal cover for a tree consists of a match at its root, one of these three matches in this case, plus optimal covers for the subtrees starting at each input of the match. Okay? So you can decompose the problem in one of these three ways, and one of those three will give you the optimal solution. That's all you know. You don't know which of these three, so you still need to enumerate locally, but you don't need to enumerate all the combinations of choices at all the nodes. So, here is a naive way of taking that principle and turning it into an algorithm for tree covering. We'll first go through it, and then we'll see if we can improve it. So, this is the min cost cover. I'm just calling it the min area cover, because in this case, we are still talking about additive cost functions. We'll talk about how we can handle non-additive cost functions, but for now, if you assume that the cost is the sum of all the match costs that are included in the cover, area is certainly one of those cases, metrics that is additive. So min area of V, P. P is a set of pattern graphs, that's the library. V is the vertex in the tree. So initially you call this min area at the root of the tree. Right? You start off by setting the best cost to infinity. And for each match at that vertex that you are currently, initially again this is the root of the tree, for each local match, so this match of V, P runs through each of the pattern graphs in your library and says, can I match this here? Can I match this here? Can I match this here? So it is, you know, sort of linear in the number of pattern graphs in your library. So for each match that you find locally at that point, you compute the cost of the match as the area of that particular match plus the sum over all the inputs of that match, the recursive call. This is where you have the recursive call to the min area, mapping of that subtree that generates those inputs. Right? So you consider all the matches locally, and you make the recursive call here. If the cost is less than the best cost you've seen thus far, you set the best match to this match, and you set the best cost to this. Right? So essentially, you're enumerating over all those local possibilities, and you're recording the best match and the best cost that you've seen thus far. Okay? Once you gone through all those local possibilities, then the final result that you have is going to be your best cost. This is the recursive call, so we've written it as a recursive function. What is wrong with this algorithm?
It's not lowering the value. Doing it every time you call a node.
Correct. This algorithm actually is exponential because, you know, even though it is a problem where you have the repeating subproblems, we are not actually remembering the solutions. So in order to make this truly efficient, you need to avoid recomputing the best cost at a node when you've seen it the second time. So you save it the first time you visit each node. And that's a trivial change. You just need to have an array of best cost for each of the vertices in your subject tree. So the best cost of the subtree rooted at that vertex is initially, let me assume that it's initially set to infinity. And at any point in this min area, when you make a recursive call to compute the min area mapping for a subtree rooted at a vertex, if you've already seen that before, in other words, if the best cost is less than infinity, you just return the best cost. Okay. And during the actual computation, what you do is you record the best cost in this array, indexed by the vertices. Okay. So all that you need to do is basically remember the best cost at each vertex, and the second time you visit a vertex, just reuse it. Okay. So a trivial change, but has a big impact on runtime. So with this, certainly this is a polynomial complexity algorithm. Okay. Of course, we assume that the array is initialized to infinity. The previous algorithm we looked at was a recursive algorithm to solve this problem. Here is a iterative algorithm to solve the same problem. Right? In this case, we visit all the nodes in topological order, are we all familiar with what topological order means? You need to order the nodes in one linear order such that any node appears after all of its inputs, all the nodes that generate its inputs. So intuitively, this is like if you have the inputs on this side and the outputs of the circuit on this side, you're traversing the circuit from inputs to outputs. And as you traverse it, you're just listing out the nodes in some linear order. Right? That is a topological sort. It's not unique, but any ordering of the nodes that satisfies this constraint, that every node will appear after the nodes that feed it. As long as that constraint is satisfied, it is known as a topological order. So we visit nodes in topological order. So as a pre-processing step, we've already sorted the nodes of your circuit in topological order. And all that you need to do is for each vertex in the circuit in topological order, you compute, you initialize the best cost to infinity, you compute the best, the cost of the match as the area of the match plus some of the inputs. In this case, you don't even make the recursive call. You just use the best cost array. And why are you doing that? Because you know that by the time you get here to this vertex, all of its inputs, you're visiting them, remember, in this outer loop in topological order. So you would have already visited the nodes that are behind these nodes in the tree, right? So if this is your tree, by the time you visit a node here, you already would have covered all of the nodes here in the tree that is rooted at that node. So anytime you are trying to look at the best cost for one of these inputs matches, the match any of these inputs, you know that you already have computed it. So you just look up the array. Okay? And finally, again, you just return the best cost. So this is an iterative version. You don't have any recursive calls. You just have, that's replaced by this two-level nested set of loops. And at the end, you return the best cost of the root of the tree. Let's look at this in action. Any questions, though, before we do that? Okay. Hopefully, it's going to get a little clearer once we look at the example in action. In order to follow the discussion or the animation here, I'd suggest that in your handouts, you open up the lecture notes where we actually have the library, the page where we have the library. It probably is the next one. It was there in the previous lecture. I don't know if you have it here. I guess not. It is in the previous lecture. So you can see why each of those matches, when I list out the matches at every node, you can see why it's indeed a match if you refer to the library. Okay? So let's just quickly walk through this example, right? These are the, we are not looking at the entire library that I had there on that slide. It's a subset of the gates just to simplify the problem. Inverter, 2-input NAND, 3-input NAND, 4-input NAND, AOI21 and AOI22. Right? These are the five cells, these are the cells, seven cells, and or six in this case, six cells, and each of the costs are listed in parentheses. This is your subject graph. It is a tree. As you can see, there is no reconvergent fan out. So we start off, the first step that we said was to sort these nodes in topological order. So we will be visiting the nodes from inputs to outputs. Okay. So we'll just do that, in the order in which we visit the nodes. So first we can visit the nodes, these four gates, which are only driven by primary inputs, and then we can visit these two, and so on and so forth. Okay. So at every node, you need to compute all possible matches. Look at all the instances of these cells and see which of them will potentially match. So we start off by looking at the gate on the top here. There is only one possible match there. It has to be the 2-input NAND. Nothing else can match this. So you list the match here, NAND 2, with a cost of 3. Similarly, the only way to match this is an inverter, cost of 2, inverter cost of 2, and a NAND 2 cost of 3. Right? So we are just annotating the possible matches as we go along. The local, these are only the local matches. Okay. Now, once we have visited these nodes, we can visit these as well, right? Because we are going, remember, from inputs to outputs. So these nodes are now ready to visit. So let's visit them one by one. So the only match here is going to be NAND 2. If you look at the pattern graphs for each of these cells, it's going to be obvious that nothing else applies here. The only match that possible here is going to be NAND 2. The parentheses now, remember, is the total cost, the optimal cost of mapping this subtree, the subtree rooted in this node. So you need to take the cost of the local match plus the cost of its inputs. The subtree is rooted at its input. So NAND 2 is 3 plus this input is 3 plus this is 2. So 3 plus 3 plus 2 is what gives you the 8. Okay? Similarly, for this inverter here, the only way of matching this using these gates is just to have an inverter here. So the cost is 2 plus 3, which is 5. Okay? Now let's move on. We'll see if we have some more interesting possibilities here. So here you could use a NAND 2, again, to match this gate. And the total cost is going to be 13. Why? It's going to be 3 for this gate itself, plus 8, plus 2, which gives you the 13. This one is going to be interesting now, because there are two possibilities. There's two possible local matches here. One local match is to just have a 2-input NAND here, in which case the total cost, that's the NAND 2 case, in which case the total cost is 3 plus 5, which is 8. Or you can match the whole subtree rooted at this node as a NAND 3, in which case the cost is 4. Okay, so here all you need to do is look at these two and compute the best among these two. So this list is only the bunch of local matches possible at this node. You're not enumerating all possibilities for the subtree. You're only looking at the local matches for this node and taking the best one. In this case, 4 is the lower cost. So we pick the NAND 3 match with a cost of 4 and record this as the best match at this node, and we move on. Okay. Here, it turns out that there is again two matches possible. The first match is the trivial one, which is just think of this as an inverter with a local cost of 2 plus 13 for the subtree rooted at its input. So the total cost of that match is 15. But there's another possibility. You can match this as an AND or invert 2 to 1. Okay. So which of these is the AOI 2 to 1? Can somebody help me out? Does anybody have the library in front of you? Yeah. What is the AOI 2 to 1 here? The inverter? The NAND here too? And the inverter in the bottom. Oh, this one. Okay. So basically, you know, this right here is your AOI 2-1, right? This is the AOI 2-1. So the cost of the AOI 2-1 itself is 4, plus you need to add 3 and 2, which is why you get the 9. Okay? So there are two possibilities here, two local matches here. You take the better one, which is the AOI 2-1 case, which gives you a 9, and then keep moving on. Here, so far, it looks like the larger cell is always the better one. But here's a counterexample to that, okay? Right, so you understood what I meant? The larger match locally, which is sort of what you do in a greedy approach, seems to be giving you the better result here. But here, it's the opposite. Because having a smaller cell here actually enables larger matches at the inputs, okay? So there's two possibilities here. One is matching it as a NAND 2. If you match this alone as a NAND 2, the cost of the NAND 2 itself is 4, plus you need to add 9 and 4 for its inputs. So that gives you 16. Did I mess up here? Pardon? Oh, I'm sorry. 3. That's why, yeah. 3 plus 9 plus 4, that's why you get 16, not 17. Okay, so this is correct, 16. The other possibility is to match this as a NAND 3. So the NAND 3 is actually these three gates together, right? If you match this as a NAND 3, the total cost of that match has to be computed using the local cost of NAND 3, which is 4, plus the cost of the inputs to that match. So the inputs to this match are 8, 2, and 4, right? So you need to add 8, 2, 4, and 4, which gives you 18. And here it turns out that the NAND 2 actually is a better match, so that's the one that is highlighted in green. Okay, so you keep that. So again, as you're going from inputs of the circuit to the output of the circuit, you're enumerating local possibilities, computing the cost of that local possibility as the cost of the math of this cell itself plus the cost of the optimal cost of the inputs, which have already been computed. Record the best cost at each node and just keep moving forward. Okay. So here there's two possibilities. Again, going with the inverter actually is better than using AOI 2-1. Okay. Going with the inverter gives you a cost of 18. Going with the AOI 2-1 gives you a cost of 22. And finally, at the output, it turns out that there's actually three possibilities to match this. You can match this as a NAND 2, NAND 3, or NAND 4. And the in terms of size, the cell in the middle actually wins out in this case. Okay. So the NAND 3 will actually use this as the NAND 3 plus the cost of the inputs, which is what gives you the total cost of 17. Okay. So hopefully that clarifies how the dynamic programming approach works in practice to actually give you the optimal cover of a tree. It's efficient. It's just one traversal of the circuit from inputs to outputs, and it's optimal. At least for additive cost functions, it is optimal. Okay. So let's discuss the complexity of tree covering. Well, the good news is the complexity of tree covering is linear both in the size of the subject tree and in the size of the collection of pattern graphs. That is the number of pattern graphs in the library. Okay, so very scalable. You know, this works beautifully in practice. This is the workhorse of all the modern commercial logic synthesis tools. You can handle million gate circuits, no problems. Of course, the overall complexity of mapping also needs to consider the complexity of computing those local matches, right? And that's just a pattern matching problem. Right, so for each pattern graph at one location in the subject graph, see if the pattern graph is a match at that point. You need to check that whether that's is a match or not, and that basically is a function of the size of the. So this is number of nodes in your subject graph because you need to do this local matching at every node in the subject graph times the complexity of matching itself. So it turns out that you know very efficient pattern matching algorithms exist. For example, there is algorithms for string matching. You can represent your pattern graphs as basically a sequence or a string consisting of, you know, you can traverse the nodes of that tree, of that pattern trees in some specific order and encode those names, which would be NAND to an inverter. So it'll basically be a string of N2 and I symbols. You can use string matching for that problem. You can encode your patterns as strings and use, in which case the complexity of string matching is actually linear. So you can do this relatively efficiently, but this still needs to be taken into account. Okay. So that's the basic idea. Okay. And like I said, this is, you know, what is mainly used in practice. It is scaled very well. All of the innovations that have preceded this basic idea have been in terms of further improving the quality of the match. How do you partition a DAG into trees? How do you take non-additive cost functions and retrofit them into this kind of an approach? Right. So we'll look at three extensions to the basic dynamic programming-based technology mapping algorithm that we just talked about. Okay. The first is known as the inverter heuristic, and the objective for the inverter heuristic is actually to improve the quality of matching. When you perform matching of the pattern graphs to one place location in the subject graph in the circuit, sometimes it turns out that you cannot match certain patterns due to additional inverters. The pattern matches except in my pattern graph I have this one inverter, or in my subject graph I have this extra inverter, right? And here's an example of that. Here's your circuit subject graph, and suppose you have a two-input NOR, okay? You could have matched the two-input NOR to the circuit except for the fact that the two-input NOR has this additional inverter here. And in this location, you know, you have these three gates as a match, but you don't have the inverter. So the question is, in these cases, is there something you can do to enable this match? Why would you like to enable this match? Well, sometimes having larger matches actually gives you a lower cost, right? So the more matches you have, the merrier, in a sense, right? Because you have more possibilities, and hopefully, you know, one of them is actually going to, those additional possibilities you create will actually lower the cost. It turns out that there is a very simple way to enable such matches. Basically, what you do is, in this case, you can always say that the input C is being fed to this lower input of the gate 7, NAND gate 7. What if I add two inverters here? Right? You know that, you know, a complement of a complement, is the original variable itself. So that doesn't change the function of the circuit. Adding two back-to-back inverters here is not going to change the functionality of the circuit. You can take one of those inverters and then you have your NOR2 pattern. You just have that additional inverter left. You might think that I'm adding additional hardware to the circuit, but again, the idea is that sometimes that actually enables you to use these larger cells from the library, thereby improving the cost of the overall match, right? So, this is one example of the inverter heuristic where adding additional inverters actually enables matches that were not possible before. So, how do you do this in a systematic manner? Yes?
Wouldn't it affect the delay?
Again, potentially, yes, but hopefully when you're doing the matching, as we will see, you will consider, a good algorithm should consider both possibilities, right? The possibility of using these inverters or the possibility of removing the inverters and restoring it to the original circuit. and whichever is actually better for delay. So just the way a larger cell is more optimized for area, similarly, sometimes a larger cell, because the designers may play transistor level tricks to have an efficient implementation of the cell, a larger cell may actually be better for delay. So to answer your question directly, it may or may not increase delay. It seems like it could increase delay, but in some cases it may, in other cases it may not, and the algorithm has to do the right thing, no matter what. Okay? So the idea is, yes, by adding these inverters, that's a very good point. You should not always add them. Because if you add these inverters all over the place, first of all, where do you add the inverters? That's the first question. Second is, if you add them all over the place, that may be excessive. Only in some cases they may enable such matches. In other places they may not enable any matches, they may just be sitting there causing overhead. You don't want that. Even if they enable additional matches, that may not be an optimal solution. The solution you had before may be as good or better, in which case you should not use the inverters. So your algorithm has to still do the right thing. You want to give the algorithm the possibility, the choice of using the inverters or not using the inverters. Okay. And we'll see how we do that. Okay. So what the basic idea is that you add dummy inverters to the subject tree. So you have your subject graph decomposed into trees. So this is your subject tree. And every internal wire that connects two NAND2 gates, remember your subject graph has already just in terms of NAND2 gates and inverters, right? So where do you need to add inverters? Well, whenever you have a connection between NAND2 and NAND2 directly without an inverter, that's where you need to add a pair of back-to-back inverters, okay? Again, this doesn't change the functionality of the circuit. It is just a virtual model of the circuit. You're not necessarily going to be using these inverters in the implementation. Like Asad said, when it doesn't make sense, you will not use them. Okay, the algorithm will choose. But to give the algorithm the flexibility, you add back-to-back inverters here, for example, and here as well, whenever you have a connection between two back-to-back, between two NAND2 nodes. And also at primary inputs, you add additional special single inverters. This is just telling you that, assuming that the primary inputs are available in complemented form, I can essentially take D prime and add an additional inverter here, for example. So what you do is basically, I've shown the back-to-back inverters here that you add between pairs of NAND2 gates. Wherever you had a direct NAND2 to NAND2 connection, you add an inverter pair. At each of the primary inputs, you add these additional single inverters, and you assume that the primary inputs are available as complements. Okay? So this is what you do to the subject graph before you do technology mapping. This is a pre-processing step. Okay? So you first do this to the subject graph. You do the same thing to the pattern graphs also, to the library. Okay? For each pattern, at every internal wire that connects two NAND2 nodes, again, you add back-to-back inverters. So here's an example of AND or invert 2-1. Originally, AOI 2-1 did not have these two inverters. You had a NAND2 directly feeding a NAND2. Add that inverter pair there. Okay. And finally, you add a back-to-back inverter pattern to the library with a zero cost. And this addresses the issue that Asad raised, that sometimes adding inverters may actually hurt you. So you also give the algorithm the choice of taking away that inverter pair with zero cost. So now the algorithm can truly make a choice whether it wants to split it up here and use one of those inverters along with the following gates to create a large cell, or just absorb those two inverters and take them back out with zero cost. Okay? So you add this additional dummy pattern to the library. And finally, you remember you also added those singleton inverters at primary inputs to enable the algorithm to get rid of them if it needs to. You also add a special input inverter as a pattern at the input of the library. Remember, the inverters that were actually in your circuit should not be matched by these. So these are actually called, different gates for the purpose of matching, right? So these are input inverters which can only match the inverters that you added, those dummy ones that you added, the inputs of the subject tree. So once you've done that, everything else is the same as before. Do your dynamic programming, and it turns out that these added inverters, both in the subject trees and in the pattern in the library, enable additional matches to be considered, potentially improving the cost of your solution. So for example, this is the circuit we had before, where we've added back-to-back inverters between NAND2 gates and additional input inverters. Once you do the matching on this circuit, it turns out that you have a possibility of using a NOT2 here, another NOT2 here, and a third NOT2. So this entire circuit can be realized with three NOT2s with a cost of 6. This additional input inverter will be matched by the zero cost pattern we added, input inverter pattern we added to the library, so it will not incur any additional cost. Okay. So if the dynamic programming algorithms finds this to be the optimal cost, it would take this. Alternatively, the dynamic programming algorithm will also consider using an AND2 here, using a zero-cost inverter pair here, using an AND2 here, and so on and so forth. Okay. Whichever is the best, better option, the algorithm will automatically figure out and do the right thing. So, as I said, the extra inverters are absorbed by matching the zero-cost patterns in the library. And in this case, it turns out that the optimal solution actually is to use those inverter pairs, split them up, and use them in two different cells. Okay. Of course, the zero-cost matches eventually when you're generating the final circuit, they are just removed. They disappear. They are cleaned out. So this is an example of an unused inverter, which will be matched by a zero-cost pattern, and when you generate the final circuit, it will go away. Okay, so that's the basic idea. So using this additional inverter pair heuristic enables more potential matches to be found, which could not have been found before. Okay. Thereby potentially improving, and in practice actually improve, it does improve the quality of the matching in many cases. All right, let's stop here. And there's a couple of additional details that I'll need to cover in the next lecture, but at which point we'll be done with technology mapping. But by this point, you have all the information you need to go ahead and finish up the homework. So just a reminder that the homeworks are due next Tuesday, a week from today.